This is 307 Net Info, connecting community.
I'm not going to say any bad words like I did on Friday. I didn't say any bad words, but that picked up and said some things. But we found, I was told after my speech that it said some bad words. But we found there is no profanity button on there. So, but that thing is really nice until it messes up. All right. So I'm going to get started. And we may have some more people come in, but this fellow right here is the reason we're having this tonight. He called me a couple of months ago, Ralph Johnson, and he said, "Do you realize how many people in Buffalo were young children during World War II here? And you really need to talk to everybody." And now I have interviewed, I didn't get Larry because he won't come in, but I have interviewed everybody. And so it's just an extension of that, and I want to introduce you by letting you know about Oral History Gathering. It's something that came into my life back in my hometown. They started doing this, going out and talking to people and recording their stories, but what we did is we put it to in theater. It was a community theater. So we gathered the stories, and then a professional playwright and a professional music person. It was beautiful.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I wanted to start you out. I am not a singer, but I'm going to do this for you. Because in that play, we always started with this song. And I'm just going to say a couple of lines of it. Okay, I'm not a singer, but here goes. It'll get us in the mood. Well, you've got a story, and I've got a story. We've all got a story to tell. Oh, you've got a story, and I've got a story. It's one you know so well. You tell me yours, and I'll tell you mine. And we'll put them all together and spice it all up. And we'll have storytelling time. And so real life, real true stories are beautiful. Now, I, a librarian, I love the ones people make up, but the real ones just really touch your heart. So what we're going to do tonight is just kind of get them started a little bit. If you have something you want to ask, raise your hand, and I will repeat your question because they're letting me know they might not hear it really good. but what, when Ralph called me, he told me he graduated in 1952. And so I went and I got the 1952 Wiomala, and almost all of these people were in it. And that was wonderful. I had invited Dolly Oberlin, so I hope she's okay, because she usually is here when she needs to be, but we'll miss her. And Wilma had given me this picture not long ago. She's right there. So what I'm going to do first is let them go down and just, I want you to say your name, your maiden name, when you were born, and when you graduated. Okay?
Can we remember that?
Yes. Yes. Start with you.
I'm Ralph Johnson.
Yeah, to hold it.
Yeah, to hold it.
Oh, and pass it down, but there's one down there too. So.
Well,
awesome.
I don't trust you.
Yeah, trust it. Don't trust that, but trust that.
Yeah. I'm Ralph Johnson. I was born here in Buffalo, March 14th, 1933. I was not born in a hospital. I was born in a house at the far end of High Street. The Buckingham House sits there now. And that was what we called the Freeman Hospital. And it wasn't a hospital. that had an upstairs, that's where I was born. I asked my mom one time, and she said, well, it was easier to get the pregnant women up the stairs than it was to get an ambulatory on a stretcher. But that was my story of where I was born and what I raised. How much more do you want?
That's it. Hand it to Jen.
What year did you graduate? Oh, you told us.
Yeah. I'm Janet Sackett Johnson, and I was born May 9th, 1933, right at the foot of the Johnson County High School, the one we miss. And it was a lady lived there, and I never heard her called anything but Auntie Muller. And she took people in that were going to have babies, and that's where Mom went. And when my dad came, he came with a big bouquet of flowers for my mom, and Auntie Muller met him at the door and said, oh, thank you, Hugh. I just love the flowers you brought me. Mom never got any. And Ralph will tell you, we started first grade together, but I'll tell you, I graduated first. I graduated in 1951.
The teacher's pet.
I was born in the same hospital that he was, just a couple years later, and it was just a house. You know, they didn't have a hospital for a long time. They had two doctors, and they each had a house. And there's a whole bunch of stories with that, but we won't go into. But there's a lot of hospital stories. Anyway, I was born in February 1st. Couple weeks from now, I'll be 89. So that's young. I'm young. 1936. And I went, all through high school, in Buffalo. Graduated in 1954. And we've got a couple 54 people here. It was the best class. These guys were okay.
Yeah, raise your hand if you went to high school with them. If anybody, I know Jim did.
Raise your hand.
Yeah. Yay. All right, Wilma.
My name is Wilma Fowler Wallace. I was not born in Wyoming. I was born in Arkansas. And my parents moved here when I was 2 years old because my dad went to work for his uncle, Klein Fowler, down on Piney, and they had all moved here because the economy was really bad in Arkansas. So they moved out here to make their fortune, I guess. Anyway, I graduated from high school here in Johnson County in 1957.
1957,
yep.
What? Just tell us your name and when you were born.
Yeah. Was I born?
Yeah, when?
My name is Larry Wallace. Actually, I didn't start school here until I was freshman in high school. I was born in Sheridan, August 19th, 1935. And I knew everything, so I didn't graduate from high school.
All right, so let me get a microphone. We only have two. Three would have been good. So we know who they are. Most of them came from families that were some of the very first white families to come to Johnson County. Ralph, the Potts family, were down in KC. And the story I read, they were about to build a blacksmith shop, and somebody bought their wood and built a bar first, or they would have had the first building in KC. But they did. They did get the blacksmith. And Janet, the Sacketts, and Louise, the Meldrums, they've all been here since the very get-go. So so we got that question. We'll see. I would like to know a little bit. So I thinking about y'all being children when World War II was going on, just tell me what was the atmosphere around town, how it affected your family, and just anything you remember. It's hard to get these memories up, but who would like to start? Just your high school years or younger? Okay.
At the time of Pearl Harbor, the city of Buffalo, going south, had three grocery stores, three clothing stores, two hardware stores, two drug stores. At the end of the sports store, that addition they added, that was a family restaurant up where the antique shop was the one-armed lady that ran the cafe, where the Thai restaurant is. If you notice, there's two doors, one you go in, one you go out. Well, the one on the north belonged to Dr. W.J. Knievel.
Yes,
doctor's office. The one on the left belonged to Bert Griggs, a lawyer. And then the big building on the corner housed the Mountain States Power Electric Company.
Wow.
I guess I'm done.
Well, before I went into childhood, then I didn't think to say it, but both Ralph's mother and my mother.
We got to put it closer. Sorry.
both Ralph's mother and my mother graduated from Johnson County High School.
Wow.
And so we heard a lot about that before we ever got there. And then, of course, how much things changed. But I'm going to start a little bit before the war. And, you know, we were just kids here taken care of. We thought we were rich. None of us knew what a dime was. But, you know, we just had a lot of fun here as kids. And people helping one another. And all and on our street, we had lots of nationalities. We had English. My mother's dad was from Germany. We had a lady from Portugal, and then Poland, and across the street was Denmark, and back of us was from Holland.
Wow.
So when it came time for holidays, the food was just wonderful, and all different kinds. But in July, before the war, they put a fence. I don't know how many of you can remember that they had the city hall down on, and kind of right where it is now, except that it had the big city, I don't know what they
The bell tower.
Well, the bell tower, but and then the dance hall above and all those things. Mm-hmm. And after my dad passed away in 1940, Mom got a phone. And up till then, we didn't have one. So, and different people would keep her up on what the news was going around. And they put a fence around those poles down there. And it said, "Help Japan, give your aluminum." And so I went to the post office and back every day for Mom in the summertime, and I came home and I said, "Mom, do we have something called aluminum in our house?" And she said, "Yes, I have an old box down here." And she cleaned out the cupboard and brought out these three pots that were pretty beat up and gave them to me to take down there and to put in. I told her, "There's a fence there." Nobody offered to help me, and I was little, and it took me a long time, I think all day, to stand there and finally get those three pots over the fence. And so when we heard that, you know, Pearl Harbor had come, I cried, and I said, "Mom, you mean we gave our pens to somebody that bombed us?" And yeah, we did. And so There's more to tell about them, but I'll let her tell it.
We each have
one. Oh, that's right.
You know, this is really fun because I'm getting more memories.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah, that's really neat. Gosh, now my memory decided to go just because.
It'll come
the thing that I remember being a little kid was that everything was rationed, you know, aluminum, the rubber and sugar and gas, and we had, sugar was rationed. And one thing I remember was we had little tiny little kind of little dishes and a tiny little spoon. And I wish I would have saved those because that was really neat. And we each got a little bunch of sugar in our little container and our little spoon. And if we could save some of this sugar till the end, Mom would have enough to make a one-layer cake. You know, you didn't have cake mix and stuff. But and my brother always got he was always out of sugar. And he was always conning, and my mom always gave him some. And I never thought that was very nice. Anyway, I mean, he broke all the rules. And this absolutely has nothing to do with World War II or any other war, except that Nancy kept telling me, you have to tell this story about your brother. This has nothing to do with the war. But we lived down when the train station was a train station, and then it was a feed store, and you took your fur down there to sell it and stuff. Anyway, but we lived right down there by that. And my dad got there. My little brother got a slingshot for a present. And he went down there, and he shot out all the windows in the train station. I mean, you know, nobody knew he did that, but the police found out that it was him. And so he had to go to court, and the judge said, you know, this was destruction of property, and so he was going to have to pay this fine. And my mother said, well, isn't that an awfully lot for just a little boy that was just playing? And the judge, John will appreciate the judge thing, the judge said, oh, it could be a lot more. So they let him off, but he had to get a bushel basket and a broom and a rake, and he had to go down there, and I sat up on the hill and I watched him. It was just glorious. And he had to clean up all the glass. And I don't know what that is. So that was my war, but anyway, back, I remember my mom and dad sitting huddled around our little radio and listening, and, you know, that they were bombing Pearl Harbor, and I was a little kid, I didn't know that much about anything, except that I didn't get the sugar that I wanted. But I will tell you, then I'll pass this on, but my dad, he didn't have to go. Everybody around him served in the war. But he got exempt not only because he had two kids, but because he was the National Weather Coordinator Observer. And I thought, you guys, I can't even believe how the weather predictions we had. But he predicted the weather, and every day he would send it in to the government, and they used the winds aloft, and he had this little thing in front of his station, and it was this little box on a stand, and it had louvers on it, and it had like four ice cream scoops, you know, one on each side, and the ice cream scoop, you could tell from how the wind was blowing by where it picked up the scoop, you know, if it was northwest. So that's how you told what the weather was. And then he had balloons. There was no rubber. I mean, that was a thing you didn't, but he had rubber balloons, great big rubber balloon, and it said, property of the United States of America government on black letters. And every morning, and I think sometimes during the day they'd call him and have him do it again, he would take that big balloon, and they must have had helium because it went up. Anyway, and he would fill it, and he would let it go, and it had a little string tied to it, and had some little, I don't know, monitor on it, and it would go up, and he would watch it go up, and then he would call in the winds of aloft for the Air Force and the plane so they'd know what was going on. I thought, you know, that was weather forecasting. Oh my goodness. But I have to finish the story, and then I'll pass this on. I thought these balloons were big. I mean, big rubber balloons. And so one day I took a whole handful of them, and I took them to grade, I was in the second grade, and I took them to school, and I was so popular with them. Until my teacher discovered it said property of the United States government on it, and she called my dad, and I had to give them all back. And I never was popular after that.
Pretty close.
Okay. Willow Clermont in the early 40s. And first thing I'm going to tell you is that he had an order to go to Denver to see if he could be in the service. Well, of course, the train went through Clermont at that time. And I remember my brother and my mom and I took him to the train station, and how my little brother, we were only like maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years old, how we cried because we didn't want our daddy to leave. Well, as it turned out, he didn't have to go because he was colorblind. And I really don't know if that was the only reason or if it was because he was also a farmer. And he raised cattle and barley and sugar beets. So then I'll jump ahead a little bit. So when Dad had his sugar beet crop, at that time we had German prisoners as to come and take care of the beets, thin them, and they had a compound, sort of a compound, in Clermont, where these fellows went and stayed when they weren't on the fields. And Dad would go in the morning in his big beet truck, get the prisoners, and they would bring their lunch. But the women, including my mom, would bake for them and cook for them. Anyway, then they'd stay all day there, and Dad would take them back to Clermont at night. And there was a barn. I could still see it and I was only about 4 or 5 years old, but I can still see it. There was a barn right by the beet field. And there was a guard that was always with them. Mm-hmm. And he had a gun. But you know what he did that whole day? He just took naps on the, I mean, those guys weren't going anywhere. I mean, you know, they were treated so well. Lots of them were musicians, and they were baseball players. They had ball games. And my aunt and uncle, John and Rose Fowler, who lived up the road a ways, she corresponded with a lot of them after the war was over. And they said to her that they were just devastated at their country by the time they got home after the war. And a lot of them became U.S. citizens after that. And so that's my story. That's a good one.
I see a few people around here that have better stories than I do. Like I said, my early years were spent outside of Sheridan there, and how many people here are the outhouses bringing water in from a well? And my mother, there was no running water, all that. I suppose some of you know about that. But anyway, my dad, they weren't too wealthy at that time. He did a little trapping to make an extra dollar or two. And one time, I don't know why, he took me with him to check his traps, and he put this one trap on a real long chain, why I don't know, but down in an underground den. But the trap was, when he went to check on it, the trap was down in the den. He tried to get the trap out. He couldn't get it out. So he sent me down there head first. He held onto my heels. I'm going down there in the dark. I didn't know if I was going to meet up with a badger or what. But anyway, I finally got it loose, and there was nothing on it. I don't know how the trap got down in there. But that was just a day's work at the time. Today that would be child endangerment.
Family didn't know if he was.
Oh, well, my mother's brother, he was at Pearl Harbor during the Japanese attack, and they were all children. Her family were in Billings for her mother's funeral, And of course, they heard about the attack, so they didn't know what, you know, maybe he was alive or dead or whatever. But he survived the war. And one of my dad's brothers, he lost his right arm in the Second World War. That was maybe good or bad. If he hadn't lost his arm, he might have wound up digging ditches. As it was, he went to school and became a teacher. But he never could learn to write left-handed. I don't know how his students knew what he was supposed to be doing. But anyway, this is way off track here. I see a person or two here that would know long, tall Jim Miller in the high school days.
I had a crush on him.
He was in
my class. Dated him. Go on with your story.
Yeah, I've heard it before.
I have no idea how Jim and me wound up in Elgin Young's geometry class. But I sat behind Jim in school. Oh, Elgin Young, if you don't know, his vision was real bad, and the lenses on his glasses were about a quarter of an inch thick. But anyway, I sat behind Jim in class, and if I slouched down as big as he was, I'd slouch down. Mr. Young couldn't see me, go from off, whatever. But one time the class was almost over. Jim, when he came in the room for the class, he just didn't pretend to hide. He laid his head down on the desk and went to sleep. And class was almost over. And Mr. Young finally saw him, and he come back there and he shook Jim. And he said, "You can't sleep in my class." Jim didn't raise his head. He said in kind of a whiny voice, he said, "I could if you'd be quiet."
Oh.
Oh, I don't know. Back in my younger days over in Sheridan, to ride a school bus. One of my favorite things, I'd get off the bus in the winter, three or four stops before mine. I'd run around back and get a hold of the bumper and ski home. And one time a big rock froze right in the middle of the road. My toes hung that rock going by there, and I flipped over and beat my head on the bumper. Put a notch in my head. The scar's starting to show now. My hair's thinner now. But you know how a head wound bleeds. Anyway, I got home, and my mother, oh, poor little darling, you know, she got me all fixed up. She asked me what happened. I thought I had her sympathy, and I told her, and she beat me severely. She thumped on me a little bit.
I got to share something before I forget.
I just don't want to forget that, you know, well, Jim Miller, that's a whole other story. My mother took me down to Claremont one time to see the German soldiers that came in to work at the sugar beets. And I remember thinking, these are just young guys. I mean, they're mostly blonde and handsome.
And they were.
And I thought, they're our enemy? I mean, that's to this day shocks me. You know, that was really something. We'll have them. I'll tell you one more and pass it on, because this is my memory of the war more than anything. We had blackouts, and at night you had to either turn your lights off or have black shades so that when the Japanese came over, if they were going to bomb, that they wouldn't tell there was a city there because it was all black. And I think across the United States they did that. But I was terrified of being bombed by the Japanese. And when, one day I'm out playing, and I'm probably, I don't know, five or six, maybe a little older, and an airplane, I could hear an airplane coming, and I was over by the Bighorn Motel, and they had a fish pond, and it was concrete, but it was the, there were no fish in it at this time. And I remember I ran and I ducked, I got in that fish pond, and I, this little girl, and I just huddled down, I put my arms over my head, and I just thought, the Japanese are going to come, and they're going to bomb us. And I saw this airplane that looked to me like it had a square tip on the wings, and it had a big red circle on it. And to this day, I have that crazy memory. And it wasn't even, you know, it was probably my dad out flying his supercar. It was a scary time.
Louise, I have one thing I want to say before I forget.
Yeah, yeah. Before we forget.
Okay, you know,
put it up close to you.
Oh, okay. I remember, you know, do you all remember, well, no, you all don't, but some the green stamps?
Oh, yeah.
Mom would collect green stamps,
yep.
And she'd get the books, and that's how she got my brother and I shoes, was and sugar, you know,
sugar.
And stuff. So, anyway.
Yeah, the green stamps.
Well, you have a thing.
Oh.
I'd like to say something, if I may.
Okay, go ahead.
You want to know what it was like in Buffalo during World War II?
Yeah.
13 men from Buffalo enlisted in the Army the day after Pearl Harbor. They got picked up in a bus that with blacked out windows, taken to Sheridan, put it on a train with blacked out windows. That was in December 10th. My mom did not know where my brother was till June of 1942, and they did not tell. And immediately when the war started, at that time we had a hobo jungle down at the New Dawn Park, was a hobo jungle. They immediately disappeared. The government come in, picked them up, and put them in the Army. And the next to go was the gypsies. We had gypsies come in. They disappeared. By 1942, the only people in this town were kids and old people. Everybody else was military. One thing had come out. Women moved into the workforce. They moved into the factories. They built planes, ships, tanks. They say the woman eliminated two men in the factory. Both people went to the war. We lost 405,000 men in World War II. Every family was affected. My mother had a brother and a son, three nephews in the Pacific. Unfortunately, one did not come home. She became a Gold Star mother. You need to look at the monument at the corner of Fort Main and realize everyone in names there come from Johnson County, from Buffalo. It was not easy. The war was terrible. When we found out that 1,177 sailors went down with the Arizona, 900 are still entombed. You know, 9,000 Marines on Saipan. The last battle of Okinawa, 19,000 American soldiers died on there. Everything was terrible. There was no good time. When Germany surrendered, we did not celebrate because Japan was next. And the troops that was fighting in Europe was supposed to go to fight to invade Japan. Well, fortunately, Harry S. Truman popped two bombs, saved a million lives. There was nobody in this town that was not touched one way or the other. It was not hard. It was terrible hard. And one of my jobs, I always had work during the war. I was the kid at the end of the railroad tracks. And where Larry Wallace's parents built their shop was a German lady lived there, really. In fact, everybody in my neighborhood was an old widow woman. And there where the art center is, the big brick building by the bridge, that was a laundry. And the lady, she hated me. And she always set her bulldog on me. Well, the next lady down there, she didn't like kids and she threw rocks. So I lived in a different neighborhood. But at the time of the war, there was 14 different nationalities here in Buffalo. 14 different nationalities. We didn't have Latinos or Hispanics. We had Mexicans. They came in. We had Swedes, Danes, Irish, Norwegians, Finns, Germans, Italians, Russians, Czechoslovakian, Polish, wow. French. Well, of course, we had the Basque influence. Some of our classmates, their parents migrated. So Buffalo was a different town. When I look at the main street today, and I look back at what we had during the Depression and the war, I'd rather go through that again. Our days, we had no... We pledged allegiance to a flag of 48 stars. We learned to sing God Bless America. And America for the beautiful, you know. And everybody contributed something. Everybody did something. The high school at one time, they called it a dry farm because the high school kids planted gardens up there on the bare ground. They called them water gardens. Everybody had a garden. Everybody. My dad had a huge garden. What he didn't use went to the neighbor. Our neighbor lady was from Austria. She spoke German. Well, my mom spoke German. In fact, my mom could speak German, French, and Latin. And if correspondence come to Mrs. Myers that she didn't understand. In English, she'd bring it to my mom. And my mom wouldn't tell her what it was. But yeah, Buffalo was different. We was patriotic. We had no flag burners. We only had one little group of ladies that was protesters. Faithfully, once a year, the WCTUers would come down in front of the office of them and preach the evils of alcohol. Beat their drum and go home. Other than that, I guess I'm done.
Well, you know, there it was true that there wasn't anybody here that wasn't affected. We had several prisoners, you know, that their families were prisoners of war in Germany or Japan. And when they came home, nobody talked. Oh, when they came home, nobody talked about it, and you didn't ask. It affected the kids too, because there wasn't anybody that didn't have somebody in it. And my grandfather came from Germany, and of course his kids were in the First World War, went to France, and so then here. And he was gone. He passed away before the Second World War came. But I went to Germany to meet his relatives in 1992. I wanted so much to know who our relatives were over there. And we got to one house, and she was my mom's first cousin, and she showed the pictures of her husband, who was in the SS. Mm. And the lady said, we had a German friend with us, and she said, "Oh my God, SS." And I said, "That's over, and don't say another word." Yeah. That's all. But wonderful people. I mean, relatives or not, they were, they treated us so well. And they came here to see my mom, and that was really a neat thing. But one of the things that we did as kids that everybody now would be horrified and they'd probably be something done with us. But you got bubble gum once in the blue moon, a penny a piece, and so all of us girls would buy 5 pieces of bubble gum, take it home and cut it up into as little bit of pieces as we could, and we'd share. But then if you got a whole piece, you chewed it a while and took it out of your mouth, you passed it to the next girl, and chewed it a while. Each one of us chewed and blew bubbles. And so you could have fun things that was going on. But we went barefoot all summer because the shoes were rationed too. And when the war was just about over, our school teacher had us write a letter. And we took clothes down here to the grade school and packed all these boxes with clothes. And then we were hoping to get a letter back. And my letter came from a girl in South Shields, England. And we kept in touch all the rest of that time. And she moved, she married, and which we talked about, we married. And then she moved to Minnesota, and she wrote me a letter, and she said, "How far is Minnesota from Wauwinyoag?" And I wrote back and said, "A long ways." In those days, you know, no interstates then. But we lost track of one another when she got here. And never did, but I still have my tin can of Queen Elizabeth when at the coronation that she sent me, so that was my treasure.
Oh man, is this bringing back memories? I have two, the bubble gum. I remember we were little kids and Dr. Meisner, a dentist, Waverly, he had an office downtown and somebody said he was giving out bubble gum. And there was a line from the school, the minute school was out, all the way, I think, from school, all the way down to get a piece of bubble gum. That was awesome. The other thing I was thinking about was the McBride family in Buffalo. And my mom took me by the McBride house, and she said, "You see this flag in the window, a banner?" And she said, and, you know, to this day, I can't remember if it was one son or two. I think that she said the stars are for somebody in the family that died during the war. And I picture two.
I can tell you about that.
You know, I think they lost two of their children, guys, in the war. And that just, I mean, I remember sitting by the Congregational Church and just looking at that, the stars, and thinking, those are people we know. I mean, these are, you know, it was pretty close. It wasn't all fun and games, but when you're little, you don't know that much. See, you see the RKO news on the matinee, and then, you know, with Roy Rogers, and you don't really realize. One other thing I have to say, I gotta stop this and let you guys talk, but I was thinking about Kathy Perry telling me one time that Bob was in the war, and she said he never would talk about it. And she said, "I'd ask him questions, and people would want to interview him, and he said, I can't talk about it," and he never ever did. It was so traumatic, I think. So,
Larry wants to say something, but I just was going to give Nancy, I'm sure you know about, there is a book. Little book published, and I can't remember now who wrote it, on all the German prisoners that were in the state of Wyoming.
Yeah.
And they used to have it at the prescription shop, and I had a copy, but I think maybe we loaned it to somebody else. But I'll tell you, it's really interesting to read, because I think they started first. The prisoners started first being delivered to around Torrington, because they grew a lot of sugar beets there. And then they, came to all parts of Wyoming, Worland and Sheridan. And at that time, Clearmont had, all the farms there grew sugar beets.
Yeah.
And I do have a few pictures of the farmer taking a nap. by the barn while the guys are working. What did you want to say?
What
did you want to say?
Oh, it's really important. No, after I moved here, I heard about three guys, the Second World War. They were just a little older, but they were put in what they called a pack outfit. They used mules to transport stuff through bad terrain and typical military operation. Most of the others were younger, just kids, like from New York City or somewhere. They'd never seen a mule. But anyway, I think one of the guys, he wound up in the Pacific Theater, but two of them went to Europe. And if I get the story right, they were in Italy, and they were going up a mountainside at night. And the Germans couldn't see them. They were just shelling the mountainside, hoping they hit something, you know. Well, this one guy from Buffalo, or well, KC, but he found a jug of wine somewhere along the line, and he'd been into it pretty hard. The other guy said he scared them kids more than the shelling, because he was running up and down the mountain. Everybody else was hiding. He was running up and down the mountainside trying to lead them mules, and he was hollering, "Hallelujah, we're going to die tonight."
So one thing I do want to fit in before we're done is you all had a lot of school teachers that had served in the war and came back, and they were your teachers. So let's reflect on that just a little bit.
Well, our first teacher that came back, we were in grade school. His name was Ahern. Colonel Daniel Ahern.
Oh, my goodness.
We all know him. He had been wounded in Sicily and had just got out of the veterans' hospital, crippled arm, walked around, shaking a tennis ball all the time, and spit and polish. His division was served under Patton, and that was a spit and polish. He brought discipline. And if you got into a hassle on this playground, Mr. Ahern would take you to the gym, put on boxing gloves, and said, "When you get it settled, come on out." That was his method. The next one that appeared, and I'm sure all of you know, George Grace. George Grace was a B-17 pilot, had 18 missions over Germany. The next one was John Driscoll. He was a major. He served in the Burma China Theater. We had a teacher come by the name of Mr. Otto. He stayed 1 year, but he had been a German prisoner of war. He was captured at the Battle of the Bulge. And we had Larry referred to Elgin Young. He was map reader for the Army. He had a vision problem. Oh, look at that. We had good teachers.
Yeah.
Our parents taught us discipline. Well, these guys taught us how good discipline could be. There was no doubt about it. I mean, they could spit and polish. And what 16, 17-year-old kid is going to challenge in combat? You know, you're not that smart. They were good teachers. It was honest teachers and fair teachers, and they taught us the way it should be taught. You know,
I had two cousins that were pilots. Thank you. I had two cousins that were pilots. One was from Cheyenne, and one was from Bighorn, and the one from Cheyenne was over the Pacific, and my cousin from Bighorn was over France, and he gave his life there. Mm-hmm. He was a fighter pilot, and when he came in, he was stationed in France, and when he came in to land, his last bomb had not released. Mm-hmm. And so when he landed, it blew up a lot of things. But his younger sister, of course, was a lot younger. And but when we were older, I belonged to DAR, and they put out they published a book of World War II people, and they asked and said that they could find that they could let you know where they were buried if they were buried overseas. And so I found that out from my cousin, and she called me up and she said, guess what I did today? And I said, have no idea. She said, I put flowers on Jack's grave in France.
Oh.
And they got hold of her and did that for her. There were a lot of good things. And there were my sister-in-law, Norma Sackett, was Norma Christensen, and her brother spent a long time as prisoner of war. Yeah, I guess it was most of the war. And she had other brothers in the war. But, you know, we weren't the only ones. On the McBrides, they lost one son, and then Bob McBride was the prisoner.
Yeah, Kelly was the last.
Well, Slat Slayton was a prisoner of war as well.
Who what?
Slat Slayton.
Yeah, he was a tail gunner on the B-17.
There's just so you know, there's a really good book that is about Slat Slayton, and he was in the Death March. It's called Glory, Guts, and Valor. And we do have it to check out, but you should read it.
Buffalo's
somewhere.
First century?
Yes.
One you have under lock and key? That should be read by everybody.
It should be, yeah.
It's a book that tells you the entire history from 1884. That's 6 years before we became a state. And the Cattle War was 1892. It's all covered. It's a beautiful book. Mm-hmm. But like I say, they don't mention the hobos. One thing that they did mention was the chapel car. This car, my family moved. My family moved to 47 North Lobbin in 1936. And when we had got there, there was a railroad car sitting at the depot. And it was called the chapel car. Gladys Larson, I'm sorry, because she went there as a small child. And it was the beginning of the Baptist Church while they was building the Baptist Church up on Burritt and Fort. It was the chapel car. That's where they met. That car is still used, and it's in Wisconsin right now. But it was a big Pullman car that had living quarters in it. My mom was a Methodist, and they were Baptists.
But she went to the Baptist Women's Circle.
She played down there for them. But, yeah, you need to advertise that book more because it's under lock and key.
For a reason.
If it's Buffalo's First Century, we do have it to check out too.
Do you?
But it is a great book.
Yep.
All right.
Me?
Yes.
Okay.
Go for it.
Now I forgot what I was going to say. Got to listen to Johnson there.
Yeah.
Distracted me. No, I was just thinking, like I said, my mother's brother was at Pearl Harbor during the Japanese attack. He was in the Army Air Corps at the time. There wasn't an Air Force. It was the Army Air Corps. And like he said, the American fighter planes, you went up in one against a Japanese Zero fighter, you're almost committing suicide. I guess he was down three times, I think. But once was a mechanical failure, and I can't remember what, but he did get shot down, but he was crashed in the water. I mean, and the Japanese fighter plane came over by, kind of wagged its wings at him and went on by. He thought he was dead, you know, with the fighter coming back at him.
Wow.
But anyway, American airplanes were next thing to useless there for a while. Then I got one story here that is doesn't pertain to anything. Back in the high school days, there was a kid, I think he only lived here about 1 year, and I don't know who he was, but he used this hair tonic. It was about 99% alcohol, and on a good hot day, you stand in the sun, you see the fumes coming off his head. If anybody not from here, if you remember the Bison Theater downtown,
oh, yes.
The old crooked stairway going up, no fire escape, and in the balcony, but you were allowed to smoke up there. So a lot of teenage boys especially go up there. But one time we were up there and sitting there, and that kid came in and sat down in front of me. But the guy next to me, he said, "Watch this." Before I could say anything, he touched off a cigarette lighter at the back of that kid's head, and it didn't burn. There was just a big poof that lit up the theater. But anyway, the kid, he squalled, and he jumped up, and he thought, since how I was behind him, he thought I did it.
Oh, no.
So he started thumping out crazy knots on my head. But anyway, Sam Rosenthal owned the theater for a little bit of age and a short, overweight guy. He was up the stairs in a big hurry and saved my life.
Oh. I got it. That's too... You know, I was thinking about Dan Ahern, and he came back from the war, and we were all his...
Afraid of him.
Oh, we were scared to death of him, and he was, I mean, he treated us all like we were his army, you know, and we were scared of him. And I was in the eighth grade, and we did something that Mr. Ahern didn't like. And he and Mr. Stifler had to go and referee a ball game somewhere. And he kept the whole eighth grade, and I picture where we were and the whole thing. And he said, "I'm trusting you guys to be on your own, that I have to leave." But he said, "You have to stay an extra half hour in school to make up for this awful thing that we did." And so they left, and the minute we saw him drive out, and Danny Ahern was in my class, one of Dan, Mr. Ahern's sons, he said, "Watch this." And he went up and he got a chair and he climbed up, and we had an old clock. And he took the clock and he took the hands and he moved them a half hour ahead, and we all left.
That's funny.
It has nothing to do with the war.
She's talking there. Mr. Ahern stood in front of me one day and said, "Johnson, you'd be the dumbest kid in this class if it wasn't for so-and-so sitting there." They say you cannot teach by embarrassment. I was so humiliated, I went home and I cracked that math book. And in 6 weeks, Mr. Ahern would say, "Johnson, slow down, you're getting ahead of me." Some kid today, how dumb they are in class, you'd be under lawsuit. It didn't bother him a bit.
And do you know how many medals Mr. Ahern had? I know he had like 2 Purple Hearts. He had a lot of... We have his oral history interview, and he had a lot of medals. And I just noticed an obituary that I think was his son, and he also got a Purple Heart.
Oh.
So it just recently, and her. So, yeah, they're pretty special people came from Buffalo.
Yes.
Do you all have any questions? Because I don't want to keep us forever. We can talk forever, but anything you'd like to know about? I would like for y'all just to close up with a few memories of the train, because a lot of us can't even visualize. I've got a map. I see how the train came. Just what memories you have of that. Because
the railroad track ended 55 yards from my mom's back door.
Right.
And when we moved there in 1936, the train was running. We had a hobo jungle.
Yep.
Hobos were not homeless. They were the happiest people in the world. Nobody was telling them what to do. Nobody was telling them where to go. They went where they wanted. And later the gypsies came. The railroad was called Claremont, Buffalo, Claremont, back maybe.
Yeah.
Because it was 504 was the engine number. And they called it Duffy because Mr. Duffy was the superintendent of the railroad. But it held thousands of tons of wool. The building next to the blacksmith shop was my mom and dad's house. Mm-hmm. And when we moved there, the railroad had a warehouse there. That's where they stored wool, the wool. When they got a railroad car full of wool, they got a car and they had it back in because no turnarounds. But that railroad was quite busy during the war.
Yes.
They brought everything in. They brought in the fence posts. They brought in concrete. They brought in everything that had come in on the east. The Salt Creek bus freightways had the route from Denver to Billings. It had a passenger service, mm-hmm. and they hauled freight. And later on, when McCready bought the place and they expanded it into a feed store, they used it as a dock. The railroad was really neat. Ask Jim Hicks about riding the rails. He can tell you the story, and I think you should. Jim, come up here and tell him this, please.
Used to lie
on
it, I fell down.
Well, you're a newspaper man. You don't know the difference of truth and
you know, Ralph knows I told this story before. When Duffy's Bluff was going to make his last run to Claremont, a friend of mine, by the name of Kells Wagner, he was a year older than I was, Kells was, but anyway, he said, let's ride that train. It'll be the last chance we get. So they were pretty careful about people jumping on trains, so we hid down to Willow Square before it took off, and when it started to go, we managed to get on a flatbed car, and we rode down there. As I remember, it was in the fall. It was fairly cool. We got down to Claremont, and it was pretty late afternoon. We were getting late in the afternoon. That was all fun and games, you know. My folks had no idea where I was, and his folks didn't know where he was. Then it occurred to us we had to get back to Buffalo, and you know, there wasn't a lot of traffic between Claremont and Buffalo those days, so we were out there on the road hitchhiking and having no luck at all. Finally, a guy came along, he had a little coupe car. I remember he had three or four kids in that car with him, but he was pulling a little two-wheeled flatbed trailer behind that car. He said, you guys want to ride on that trailer? You can. And I said, okay. So we lay on our stomachs and pulled out of the front of that trailer. And I'm going there, look at that empty. We did that all the way to Buffalo. It was cold, so cold. I wanted to turn loose so bad I couldn't understand it. But we managed to get back to Buffalo. Then all hell broke loose after that. It was late, and my folks didn't know where I was, and the distance was not going to be. We made the last ride to Claremont on Buffalo, Claremont back, baby.
That's awesome.
You know, I thought this was mostly going to be about World War II.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you one short thing about our family. Kind of odd that this happened, but I was born in Gillette in 35, and my sister was born, she was a year older than I was. But our dad got real sick in December, or November that year. So the doctor said that we should move, and my mother actually loaded us into a two-door 1934 Chevrolet car. It had, you know, it had a seat by just two doors in the back seat. And I remember there was a trunk on the back seat and a blanket on that trunk. And my sister and I laid up on that trunk. And my mother drove us from Buffalo to California. And I think she must have drove all night. Well, the last night we were going, because we got into Pasadena, California real early in the morning. I remember that. And we had a cousin, my dad had a cousin there, and we went up to their house, and we got out of the car, and of course I was pretty young, I was only five or six, and my sister was like seven or eight. And I can remember so glad to get out of that car and be able to run around the yard a little bit. But the people were all somber, and they were the relatives were. I thought they were in the house goats or something, but they were sitting there around the radio. They all just seemed so serious. And I found out what it was. That was the day that they bombed Pearl Harbor, and so my folks got there. And then I don't remember a lot about it, but I do know there was a lot of hysteria going on in California at that time because people thought they were going to attack the West Coast right away. And there was a lot of nervousness about that. We lived in several places. I think we were pretty hard up for cash at that time. But I do know that when I would go to the park to play, that there would be anti-aircraft guns there with sandbags around them, and there were soldiers there. And we were swinging on the swings, and these guys were so big because they thought Japanese airplanes would be coming, I guess. At one time during the war, but we were out there. We moved back to Buffalo in 1945 when the war ended. But the one time that I do recall it, they surfaced a submarine out there and shelled some, fired a few shells into some oil tanks there at Long Beach, set them fire, scared that Jesus out of all those people from Oklahoma over there looking in the air past factories. The next day they had their mattresses on their cars and they were headed back. I've talked enough. Thank you.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
Can I tell you one more thing about the Depression?
Please.
My mom and dad and everybody's family started in 1929. It was called a depression in history books. We didn't look at it as a depression. We just looked at it in hard times. Later in life, my dad said, I didn't lose a thing during what they called the Great Depression, because when you don't have anything, you have nothing to lose. My dad did not have a bank account. My dad did not have a savings account. He didn't have any portfolio. His money was in his right-hand pocket, always in change. That's always where he carried it. So we really didn't see the Depression as it was back east, where the bankers, high financiers, just jumping out of buildings and everything. And I got to thinking one day about the Depression. My dad was working for the Chevrolet garage, and that's if you go to the T section there on Fort Main, that big building, that two-story building, was the Chevy garage there. He bought a brand new 1932 Chevy car. Wow. You know, in the middle of the Depression, everybody did. He bought a house from the First National Bank, financed his house in 1936. So the Depression did not affect lots of people. You had to have something to be affected, you know. And I think he should say something, because Edie was a ranch guy during the Depression, and they had an entirely different situation than we did in town. Edie?
All right.
If that's all right.
Yeah.
Edie?
Perfect.
Well, when the war started, I was living on an isolated ranch out of Leiter, up towards the Montana line. And I can remember when we heard it on the radio, too, that the Japs had bombed Pearl Harbor. And my dad was so upset. I was eight, so I didn't really understand what was going on. But I was really distressed because he was upset. And so as the time went on, we did everything we could do for the war effort. We gathered up iron. I could remember my mom and my sister and I going out horseback and gathering up cattle carcasses, the bones. They wanted bones. And when we went to town, which was only about once a month, we would take those and buy savings bonds, or savings stamps, and until we got enough stamps to buy war bonds. And then at school, we learned all the all the service songs, you know, the Army and the Navy and all of them, and we would sing those, and there wasn't any blackouts. We lived so far from town, and of course our only news was the radio. And then I do remember when we came to town to go to high school one time, there wasn't anybody to pick up potatoes out at the 41 ranch. They did a lot of potato growing out there. So they let us out of school to go pick up potatoes. And I remember that too. So, but it was an interesting time.
Thank you.
Nancy, I have one little story about the railroad.
Yes.
Well,
get it closer.
Okay. The railroad, of course, came through Claremont. Well, my dad, like I said, raised sugar beets. So in the fall, you had to top the sugar beets, and they had to be sent to, I think it was Worland or Hardin at that time. I don't remember that.
Sheridan, I think.
Was it Sheridan?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, of course, Dad didn't have, you know, fancy equipment back then. But you had to, he did have a thing that would pick the sugar beets up off of the field after they'd been topped. And those were usually done by the Mexicans. And then this machine would load them in Dad's truck. And then my brother and I had to run along beside and pick up the big ones that had fallen off. And then Dad would take them into Claremont, and you know that big elevator that's in Claremont? Mm-hmm. Well, that's where, then he'd drive his truck upon, he had a big scale, because I went many times with him, and then the train would pull in there, and then I don't remember how he got the sugar beets out of the truck, because it didn't have anyway, they got the sugar beets out of the truck, loaded into the train, and then the train would take them on to Sheridan or Hardin.
Yeah, there was a sugar beet factory there in Sheridan for a long time.
Oh, Holly, that's sugar. Right, there was. Yeah. Yeah.
Holly Sugar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I do scrapbooking, and after my parents died in their stuff, I found a lot of the little tickets that Dad had gotten when he delivered his sugar beets, so I put those in the scrapbook.
All right. Thank y'all so much. This is 307 Net Info, connecting community.